This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the program. The white Christian vote is the key to Donald Trump's survival. But with some fancy footwork by the left, could it be up for grabs in 2020? And 70 years after the world's leading powers signed the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, why, almost every day, are its rules violated somewhere in the world? I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. First, though, the newspaper company, formerly known as Fairfax, now owned by Channel 9, is running a campaign to change Australia's defamation laws. The Sydney Morning Herald and The Age have lost or are facing major defamation cases. They're pushing to change the laws, which are some of the toughest in the world. But are there ethical problems in allowing the media to publish or broadcast stories that can destroy reputations? Dr. Matt Collins is a Melbourne QC and an academic who specialises in defamation.
In Australia, of the Western democracies, we are the only country not to have a constitutionally entrenched Bill of Rights in one form or another. And what that means is that with defamation laws, I would contend the balance has swung too far away from freedom of expression and too far in the direction of protecting the right to reputation in a way which is having a really significant impact on Australian public discourse.
But shouldn't the media be required to publish that which they know to be true? Is that such a terrible threshold, Matt, for broadcasters and publishers to reach, that you print or broadcast that which you believe or know to be true?
Well, there's a big difference between what you believe and what you know to be true. And Andrew, you're quite right in most cases. But if you think about public corruption, the exposure of matters which people in power would rather not have exposed, it becomes important, in my view, for the media to have some breathing space. Often, stories of the highest importance, you think about Watergate in the United States, for example, are the result of information, reliable information, being provided to the media by whistleblowers or by leaks or by confidential sources. Confidential sources are useless in a legal sense because they'll never get in a witness box at a trial and swear up to what they have said to a journalist. But for all that, the information which is disclosed by them to journalists can often be of the highest public importance. If public malfeasance is to be exposed to the antiseptic of public scrutiny, I would contend we must allow the media some breathing space in some circumstances to publish material which turns out to be false.
But surely the only logic, Matt, is that this is a fishing exercise, that you throw out an allegation, you're not sure of how true it is, but you throw it out in the hope that someone might come forward to back it up. I mean, is that the basis on which we want people's reputations, their livelihoods, even their lives to be judged?
No legal system in the world would tolerate that, not even the American legal system. Even in the United States, the media will be liable in defamation law, for example, for publishing material that they know to be false or which is published with what's called actual malice. Our system is much stricter than that, and the media, I'm not contending for a broad right of immunity for the media, I would simply argue that where journalists have acted responsibly, having regard to the ethical precepts of their honourable profession, the law ought to cut them a bit of slack where the subject matter is of the highest public importance, such that freedom of expression in the individual case ought to prevail over the right of an individual's reputation.
We're still living in the shadow of the News of the World that was hacking the phones of a dead girl. Media people went to jail. Aren't we setting up a situation here where the dishonourable and the unethical have a legal shield if we change the defamation laws?
Andrew, it's not a black and white situation. There are gradations of grey. I've been doing this for the best part of 25 years. In my role, often I review stories prepared by journalists of the highest calibre who will tell me that they profoundly believe in the truth of what they have written or proposed to broadcast. When I read the stories or watch them as a citizen, I form the view often that these stories are of the highest public importance and the public ought to have the right to know them. But as a lawyer, the advice I have to give is that our laws are so restrictive, so tilted in favour of plaintiffs, that the stories cannot see the light of day. I think that is profoundly corrosive of sophisticated public discourse.
You make a very powerful point, but you speak only of those cases where journalists and the media are doing the ethical thing, exposing corruption at the highest levels. But the reality is that any liberalisation of our defamation laws will also be used to traduce the reputations at times of quite innocent people, little people. The tabloid television, their exposés are of neighbourhood disputes. So it will have a very damaging effect on often vulnerable people, won't it?
Not in my view if the laws are properly calibrated. And properly calibrated laws have been formulated in just about every country that we like to compare ourselves with, notably the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Canada and so on, without leading to the sorts of social collapse that you're predicting. Andrew, the important point is to recognise when there is a public interest in freedom of expression. Now, when the neighbour is being falsely accused of criminal conduct, there's no public interest in freedom of speech in those circumstances, such as would prevail over the right of the individual. But the position is different when people in positions of power are involved and when the subject matter is of the highest public importance.
Just finally, Matt, is there an irony that we've got some people on the liberal left who are calling for more restrictions on freedom of speech in the sense of wanting us, and I know this, to include religion in anti-racial vilification laws and to mandate that we use gender-neutral pronouns, and yet at the same time they're calling for freedom for the media to allow them to accuse people of serious crimes?
I think we have a real problem in this country in relation to matters of civic education and an understanding of why classical rights matter. As a country, we lack a moral compass when it comes to how to resolve conflicts between different fundamental rights. I think that's because, as I said before, uniquely of all the Western democracies, we don't have a charter or bill of rights.
That's Melbourne QC and defamation expert Matt Collins, and you're with Andrew West. In 1948, in the shadow of the Holocaust, member states of the new United Nations signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Many of the key advocates were women, including Eleanor Roosevelt and Australia's Jessie Street. The signatories agreed on 30 articles covering everything from the freedom from torture to the right to education and religious liberty. This weekend, Amnesty International Australia marks the 70th anniversary of the declaration with an event at the Sydney Jewish Museum. The National Director of Amnesty is Claire Mallinson.
Women played a really important role. Eleanor Roosevelt really was the driving force. But there was also a very courageous Indian woman who doesn't get a lot of mentions, Hansa, who actually just at the last moment did a little bit of really important work and editing, because the original Universal Declaration talked about all men being equal. And she changed it and advocated to ensure that it was all human beings are equal. And I think that's such an important part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But Australians also played a leading role, because obviously Doc Evatt was there, and he was ensuring that not only Australia's voice was there at the development of the UDHR, but he oversaw, because he was president at the time, the actual declaration coming into being.
It has 30 articles. We're not going to go through them all. Give us a general idea, though, of what those 30 articles in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights attempt to codify.
Well, it provides the framework which, you know, all international human rights laws and standards flow from. So it talks about the right to life, the right to freedom of expression, the right to be free from torture. And obviously what we've seen flow from that are things like the Convention Against Torture. It codified the rights for refugees to seek asylum, which has led to the Refugee Convention, which obviously now is under threat from countries right around the world. So that real framework that, you know, we often now take for granted in terms of right to liberty and freedom of speech.
I guess as I reread the articles of the Declaration, it seemed to me clear that there was not a single article that is not being breached somewhere in the world by a government. I guess that's why great organisations like Amnesty International continue to exist. Are some of these, or most of these articles, simply being ignored in places around the world?
Well, as ever, when you sit back and reflect, you know, it's 70 years, as you said, since the Declaration came into being, you know, there has been major strides and major progress. The UDHR really was the forerunner of things like the Millennium Development Goals and now the Sustainable Development Goals. And that's led to millions of people no longer being in poverty. However, somewhere around the world, people's human rights are being abused. There's still huge discrimination, and it's often women who actually are impacted the most. And, you know, I've recently come back from visiting Cox's Bazaar, which is now the world's biggest refugee camp, where I met a number of women who have experienced huge discrimination and abuse.
So you meet the Rohingya women. How are their rights under the Universal Declaration being violated?
It goes back to what's happening, obviously, in Myanmar, where they're under an apartheid-like regime. Mm. So the women that I met, if I think about Ambina and Sayonara, Ambina's never had the opportunity to go to school. So she's had no education. She was beaten so badly by the Myanmar military that her leg is no longer straight. It's bent. She couldn't walk, so she had to use her life savings to pay somebody to carry her 5 days over the border, because the Myanmar military went in, they burnt down her home. And the other women that I met in that camp, there was only one woman who had any form of education. All of those women had been abused, either sexually or physically. Mm-hmm. All of those women had seen a member of their family murdered in front of them. So every aspect of the UDHR has been violated that situation. Yeah,
you've just nominated about seven areas. They've denied her freedom of religion. She has been subject to torture and arbitrary imprisonment. She's been denied education. The importance of what this declaration stands for is, I guess, in a way, encapsulated by those who don't have it.
Absolutely. And it's the most marginalised who are always under attack, which is why it's up to us as individuals and, you know, organisations like Amnesty to continue to shine a light and to continue to hold those responsible to account. One of the positive things that has flown from the UDHR, of course, is the International Criminal Court. And so that's why Amnesty is calling for accountability of the Myanmar military. You know, our research has identified that at least 13 senior Myanmar military generals have been responsible for ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity, war crimes, all the things that, you know, caused the UDHR to come into being in 1948. So, you know, it's up to us as individuals, but it's also up to our governments to show leadership and to ensure that those people who perpetrate these despicable acts of violence and abuse are held to account. Otherwise, the cycle continues. And that's why the UDHR came into being, because they didn't want that cycle to continue again and again.
Well, we can talk about Burma, and we can talk about Saudi Arabia and places like that. Tell me, though, a good place. Which is a country which in Amnesty's indices does very well on human rights that a country, even a country like Australia, which would do pretty well, can aspire to?
in many respects, Australia has been a terrific advocate for human rights. It's been a driver. It helped create the Arms Trade Treaty, which is about restricting arms being put into the hands of people who will carry out abuses. But also, obviously, it can do fantastic things, and it's recently put sanctions on some of those Myanmar military I've talked about. But it needs to be consistent. That's one of the things that Amnesty are always calling for, is that leaders and governments must be consistent in human rights. They can't pick and choose which parts of the UDHR or which human rights they want to support. And of course, here in Australia, we've got some weak areas, treatment of refugees, but also, you know, the situation for our First Peoples, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, you know, is still a major issue. And when I travel internationally, people scratch their heads and say, how can a country like Australia, which is so fantastic in so many ways in protecting and defending human rights, be so poor in its treatment of its First Peoples and refugees? So we have a really important role to play in improving not only our human rights record, but people that we trade with, people that we are friendly with. And one of the great things with friendships is you should call it as it is.
Claire Mallinson, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Andrew.
Claire is the National Director of Amnesty International Australia. And this weekend, it marks the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And people can go to the Amnesty website where they can be part of that annual Right for Rights campaign. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Well, you know the script. The white Christian vote locked in behind Donald Trump, the megachurch pastors smoothing his path to re-election in 2020. Behind the scenes, though, there's an effort to cleave the religious vote away from the Republicans. And it reaches back to a time when evangelicals were a key part of a progressive populist movement. Luke Bretherton is with the Kennan Institute for Ethics at Duke University in the US, and he wrote about this movement in a recent piece for The Guardian.
I think the image is largely driven in the contemporary moment by the alliance between white evangelicals and Donald Trump and his presidency, where he's made very explicit and direct appeals to them through things like appointments of Supreme Court judges and the like. And then through particular policies, they've been very vocal in their support. And they were really a key base that enabled him to win the victory in the last election, and have held steady in their support of him and given him a kind of strong foundation for his ongoing credibility within the Republican Party. So I think in the minds of Democrats and various progressive folk, this is seen as a very problematic relationship. And even though it would seem to be an unlikely alliance, but I think that's not necessarily true if we look historically at various figures in America through American history. Huey Long would be one such example. He was a governor in the early 20th century. You would see this kind of alliance emerging. But I think in the contemporary moment, it's that particular alliance which is causing a certain degree of anxiety, if you like, amongst Democrats.
Although, Luke, you mentioned Huey Long, the former Louisiana governor, he's a little different to Donald Trump. I mean, Huey Long said every man a king. Now, he was a crude populist in many other ways. But the populism today, especially the religiously inflected populism of Donald Trump, isn't it ultimately a populism of the rich?
I don't think that's quite true. You have Trump taking advantage of certain very real grievances, people feeling shut out, or of a sense of a kind of a dominance of how populists would frame it, a liberal elite. I think it's too easy to dismiss this as a kind of populism of the rich. And populism isn't necessarily just exclusively the domain of the poor or the working class. That's one of the distinguishing features of populism. This isn't necessarily a working class phenomena. It's a non-class-based politics. But I think the kind of combination of what Trump is doing in terms of certain kinds of appeals taps into very real grievances and very real problems, undoubtedly issues of racism and broader anxieties about immigration. But I think it's too easy to just say this is just a kind of manipulation of a certain kind of demagogic elite.
One of the things that you point out in this very perceptive piece that you wrote with Daniel Steinmetz Jenkins is that there is, however, a much stronger tradition of religious left-wing populism in the United States, which will surprise people. Just give us an idea of the roots of that religious left-wing populism.
So I think the biggest flowering of it you get in the 1870s onwards through to the 1890s of what was called the populist movement. And it comes to fruition in the alliance between what became the Populist Party and their collaboration with the Democratic Party and the presidential candidacy of someone called William Jennings Bryan. He contested, for example, the 1896 election. And this was drew on evangelical sentiment, particularly kind of Baptist and Methodist revivalist tendencies, and worked primarily with people involved in mining and farming. It was a strange kind of mix of people, and definitely included people who went on to support the Ku Klux Klan. So it wasn't all savory. But it really challenged the banking interest and the dominance of financial elites and called for the nationalization of the railways and the postal service and what was called the Omaha Platform. And you find this current going on. Interestingly enough, Martin Luther King explicitly referenced the Southern populists in his final years when he was forming the Poor People's Campaign to try and build bridges between working class whites and working class blacks to kind of challenge again the dominance of certain economic interests in the states. And I think you find again and again this current in the contemporary moment, someone like William Barber, who's a preacher and leading a revived version of the Poor People's Campaign, again explicitly references the populists looking back to the 1870s, 1890s movement. So I think populism in America has both left-wing and right-wing versions. And sometimes you find people traveling between those two poles. And a figure like Huey Long, who you mentioned before, is an interesting version of this. I would say he has both kind of left-wing elements to what he was doing and right-wing elements and kind of demagogic elements. So populism is always ambiguous. It always makes kind of technocratic and liberal elites very nervous because you're never quite sure which way it's going to go. It can challenge in a strong way and be a progenitor of democratic renewal, or it can also go very ugly and turn in a very bad way.
Yes, but I like your reference to a prophetic populism, which incidentally goes beyond the shores of the United States. You would argue, I suspect, that someone like the great Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa was a progressive prophetic populist in what he did in helping to tear down apartheid.
I think there are a number of figures in the anti-apartheid struggle. If you don't turn to basically a Marxist revolutionary theory or some other kind of version of a kind of revolutionary idea, but you do want to value the people and combine that with religious frames of reference to kind of mobilize people and stage your claims to justice and to the importance of looking after the least, the lost, and the last, then some combination of religion and populism is again and again and again the way things go. And I think it's a very interesting dynamic and very important dynamic that's often ignored or viewed in different terms. But actually, it is this combination of religion and populism we find again and again from the 15th century onward as a kind of key agent of democratic renewal.
So, Luke, what opportunities do you think the Democratic left in America has missed to engage with religious people, particularly over the last 10, 15 years?
I think there's numerous instances of that. The most striking one in many ways is the whole question of abortion. The Democratic Party has in some ways kind of made the question of whether you're pro-choice and whether you're support abortion a kind of talisman of entry into the Democratic Party. That puts off a lot of people who would otherwise support platforms of greater economic democracy and social justice in a whole range of areas. We might call them kind of pro-life Democrats. And I think they're also in minoritized and marginalized communities, both Black community and Latinx communities. Catholics in particular, who would be supporters of the Democrat Party, find themselves put on the outside or somehow put off being supporters by the whole question of abortion. There seems to be no intrinsic reason, if you're building a broad coalition, why you make that issue the kind of ticket of entry.
Luke, ringing in my ears are the words of the New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, who is a conservative Catholic, but he did make a rather, I think, interesting observation where he said to progressives in America, if you don't like the religious right, wait until you meet the non-religious right. What do you think he was speaking of there? Because it goes partly to the issue that you've written about in The Guardian.
So I think there's two strands to this. One is the kind of libertarianism, which is hyper-individualistic, unmoored from any religious or moral commitment. And so there's no support for redistributive policies. There's no such thing as society as such. They're just individual choices. So really what we need is a kind of hyper-marketization of everything, and any kind of social safety net is anathema to this kind of framework. And it's a framework that you can't hold to account by any moral or religious framework, as you could with the religious right. At least there could be an argument about, let's say, how to interpret the Bible and whether Jesus favored the poor and what that might mean for social policies. And you could make moral appeals to that. What do you do when you have governing philosophies with large appeal to certain kind of right-wing constituencies, which see any kind of moral claims as a form of weakness or a false imposition? And so there's that kind of side of it. I think the other side of it is, at least with the religious right, again, for all the problems, and I'm not a fan by any stretch of the imagination, with them, the kind of patriotism was also anchored in a definite Christian framework. Now, what happens when Christianity becomes an identity marker and is mobilized simply as a mode of kind of identifying yourself over and against others, and isn't because you're going to church on a Sunday or reading the Bible regularly, and again, is disconnected from any actual ethical or moral framework within Christianity or any kind of doctrinal connection, and is a kind of vague sentiment. And Christianity at that point becomes a form of identity politics. And I think that's what we're seeing emerging, which is very different from the religious right of the 80s and 90s.
Something that I think complements exactly what you've said was a recent voter study group survey of Trump voters. And it showed that the less Trump voters went to church, the more likely they were to say that being white was very important to their identity.
It was a very interesting survey, and I think it is an indicator of if people are rooted in actual living faith communities, there's at least a space through which one can have an argument about how to interpret the Bible or how we should think about who Jesus is and what his priorities are. When people aren't in church and Christianity has just become a vague sentiment, it becomes unaccountable to anything. And actually, what's primarily going on is this connection to some other kind of framework, such as nationalism. Nationalism is dressed up in a religious garb. And so I think that is a very worrying development. That's one of the things that I think evangelical leaders in particular should be very concerned about, but don't seem to be. And I think that's a deep mistake on their part. Also, you see it, a sense, in Europe. And it is a strange form of kind of religious identity politics that's emerging.
That's Professor Luke Bretherton of Duke University. He's got a new book out. We'll come back to him on that next year. And you can hear a longer version of that discussion at the Religion and Ethics Report homepage at the RN website. A special thanks this week, after many years of brilliant service, our sound engineer Judy Rapley is retiring. Her career exemplifies professional excellence, and I, especially Judy, will miss you very much. Thanks to Mutta Tadias and to Wayne Ewan. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.